You're listening to the Best of the Morning Show podcast. Today's best segments from all 3 hours rolled into one.
So we're in the second segment of hour one of the morning show. We're going to talk a little bit of Tennessee baseball. We're going to welcome back a guest on the show from episodes past. As John called him, Vol Mainstay, Kirby Connell is joining us this morning. Kirby, good morning. Thanks for joining us, man.
Good morning. Good morning. How are y'all?
Doing great. Hey, before we get to some of the business of baseball, I wanted to talk about an event that you're involved with. Certainly resonates with me as a pretty recent board member at East Tennessee Children's Hospital. You're doing a pretty cool event with them right now. Love for you to take a moment and just elaborate on that.
Yeah. So, you know, I've been working with East Tennessee Children's Hospital in the past. And then one thing that I want to do is, you know, I want to raise awareness to the kids and the families that are there. So what I'm doing, me and my dad has season tickets. So he's going to end up, we're doing like a donation, raffle, whatever you call it. So his for his Sunday, I think it's Sunday, LSU tickets. He is going to, he's raffling them off for a donation. So the donation is all the way up to $2,000 right now. So you get the tickets, and some of the money goes to the Children's Hospital, and some of it goes to the foster kids program, which I'm doing, just raising awareness to those kids and being able to, you know, provide for them. My thing is, you know, I've experienced a lot with kids that are in foster care and kids that are in children's hospitals. So, like, I want to raise awareness for them. So, for me, this donation is it means a lot. And so, with that, you get the tickets to the game. You get you're raising awareness to the kids in children's hospital and the foster program, and then you also get to go to dinner with me and another individual.
How do people go and bid on this?
You can bid on it. You can send your bid in to volleyfingers@yahoo.com.
Volleyfingers@yahoo.com.
Yes, sir.
All right, let's talk some baseball. First of all, how's the arm feeling? You are pitching a lot more than we anticipated. Was it more than you anticipated coming back? How you feeling?
I feel good. Arm feels good. You know, I ain't got a lot of bullets left in this arm as I'm getting older. But, no, it's good. It feels good to get out there every single time I get out there when Coach D puts me out there. But, you know, like you said, you know, I never know how long I'm going to throw. It could be one out. It could be 94. It could be one out. It could be one pitch. It could be 94 pitches. You never know.
Let's do a vibe check. Game one against Georgia on the wrong side of a blowout. You know, they come in, they really make a statement with that offense. Game two, Georgia gets off to a really good start. I think got us up as much as 7-3. And then from that moment on, Tennessee flipped a switch, goes on, wins game two, gets a shutout victory in game three, a big series win. What's the vibe of the team right now?
Yeah, you know, we're just going to look at it as our next task. For us, it's getting this lift in this morning and then go ahead, getting on the bus and head to Auburn. But, you know, just mainly, you know, doing what we're supposed to do. You know, we're supposed to go out and win games. I'm supposed to go out there, try to win every single pitch, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to try to go out there and win every single pitch, and if we don't, then, you know, look at it as the next step.
You know, as sports fans, you watch sports movies, and you always think about, you know, how dramatic the locker room must be and a rallying cry after a loss like on Friday. Was there a moment like that where, you know, Vitello had some type of message? Because, you know, a 16-2 loss, Tennessee hasn't been on the wrong side of many of those since he's gotten here.
Yeah, you know, he talked to us and was like, hey, like, I know this is not how you want to lose. You know, this doesn't look really good on us. But we look at it as basically who has the advantage for the next day. Who can go home, who can wash it away, who can get ready for the next game. And I think that's what we did. For us, it was basically, you know, forget about it. That's why we play three games. It's a three-round fight. If you win the first one, you got to get back on, sit down on your stool and get back up off the stool and be ready to fight for round two and round three.
As kind of the elder statesman of the pitching staff, can you talk about Sunday's performance from Xander Seacrest, because he was nails?
Yeah, it was exactly what we needed. We used a lot of guys on Friday and Saturday, a lot of key guys that, you know, like, we needed Xander to go a long time because I wouldn't say we didn't have pitching, but it was working for us. We didn't have a lot of guys that, you know, were going to go out there that we could trust in that situation. And Xander did what he did and then gave it off to Snead to finish it off. So it was truly, truly amazing to see what he did and how he was able to, you know, go out there and do what he does best and show us what he actually can do.
Kirby, when you've had a couple of guys in that pitching staff a little bit banged up, you know, guys like A.J. Russell, you know, Stamos for a little bit there, and, you know, you've just kind of got to pick up the slack in other areas. Does that kind of, once you get through that and you've kind of weathered that storm a little bit, does that give you a lot of confidence kind of as a pitching staff to be able to kind of pick up the slack of some of those guys when they might be down, just knowing the kind of talent that they have when they do come back?
Yeah, we got a lot of guys. Like you said, you know, when Russell's down and Stom was down for a little bit, we got a lot of guys that had to step up. And that's what V and Coach A told us. It was like, hey, we got a lot of guys that are injured right now or, you know, are making their way back. But, you know, talk to the younger guys, it was like, all right, we got to show what you're made of. You got to show you have the confidence out there, show who V can trust when he's out there. And mainly it was, you know, it was a lot of the younger guys took advantage of that. They were like, all right, well, if that's the case, then I'll go out there and I'll show what I can do. And I think that's what happened. It really showed us on Tuesday, last Tuesday, who actually could really throw for us and who could help us on the weekend.
Hey, Kirby, I was looking at your, and again, I know it's fueled by that five-inning appearance against Georgia. I was looking at this season versus last in terms of innings pitch. You're already equal.
I'm already at the same exact innings. Yes. Same exact innings, same exact ERA. It's crazy.
It is. And so my question to you, you kind of, you know, joked about it where you said, you know, you got only so much left in that arm, which, you know, as an older guy, I laugh because you got a lot left. But as you head into the part of the season, now it's going to become even more of a grind with some of these big series coming up, you know, with LSU and others down the road. Is it, you know, how do you foresee, you obviously will be out there whenever you're called upon by Tony, but is this a series where it's kind of like you're hopeful maybe you get a little rest for that arm, or are you just ready to take the ball any single time he comes to you?
I think for me, it's you know, just whenever Coach V tells me to go out there and tells me to stay out there however long. You know, that's my thing with him is, you know, he's going to make the call, and if whatever he rolls with, you know, that could be one out or it could be 15 outs. I don't know. So basically, you're just going to roll out there and see what Coach V has for us.
When you go out to take the mound, do you have any type of idea of how long you're going to pitch? I'm interested about the mindset there because, you know, you say you just want to take the ball as long as he'll give it to you. But after every batter, you kind of look in to see, like, hey, is he coming to get me? Like, hey, I'm at pitch 60 already. What's happening here? Or you just get the groove and just keep throwing. Do you have any idea? At the beginning of each appearance?
No, we have no idea. But there are some times where I can read the situation and see, okay, like V's going to put me in this situation and I'm going to be done. And then he's going to go to the next guy. But I think it all depends on the situation and depends on like who all's thrown before me.
What was the message early in the season? You know, SEC play, you got off to a slow start when it came to close games, you know, the blown game on game three against Alabama and game two, the next series. What was the message in the bullpen after kind of, you know, not coming through, for lack of a better term?
Coach A just talked to us and it was like, hey, like, nothing's going to beat you. You guys have the stuff that, you know, you can beat anybody in this league, you can beat anybody in the nation, but you should go out there and trust it. I think we had a lot of guys that really just didn't trust their stuff. And, you know, they're getting caught up in, okay, well, Coach A called this pitch, I need to throw it. No, if you got a lot of confidence in what you got, then you can go out there and throw whatever you want. So I think it was just having the trust and having the confidence in yourself to do it.
Kirby, so with, you know, Billy Amick down, kind of with a strange injury, I guess, you know, can you just talk a little bit about the emergence of those two freshmen kind of in that corner infield spot there with Dean Curley sliding over to third, and then the emergence of Ariel Antigua being able to come back from that early season injury. Obviously, he really flashed the leather kind of in his debut there. Can you just kind of talk about how confident you guys are as a pitching staff, even in just having those really young guys being in the corner infield there?
Yeah, those two guys, they work their tail off. Both of them, you know, they're in and out, you know, just basically, you know, getting better in the cages, getting better on defense. And they spend a lot of time out here on defense just working on their craft, whether that's short or third. But mainly it's, you know, having the trust of the pitching staff to be able to know that those guys are behind you and know that they're going to make the play. They're going to make the hard play. They're going to make the easy play. Whatever it is, any ball on the ground, they're going to make it. So just earning the trust and building the trust with those two guys, and not just those two guys, just all the guys in the infield, knowing that we can trust them. We work with them every day. So just being able to go out there and, you know, have that confidence and have the trust with those guys behind you that, you know, anything on the ground, it's going to be an out.
So walk us through the schedule. Obviously, you're down in Auburn this weekend. Are you guys, is today the travel day, I assume? Are you guys going down today?
Yeah, we're leaving at 10, or 11, sorry. We got a morning lift, a little bit of study hall, try to get all of our stuff done before anything's due or before we get caught up in the weekend. And then we'll get down there sometime around 4 or 5. We'll practice for an hour, and then we'll come back to the hotel, rest up, and then be ready to play tomorrow night.
All right, you can go and bid on the Sunday LSU game and support a good cause. VolleyFingers@yahoo.com if you want to make that bid. Kirby, anybody else you want to give a shout-out on the way out?
No, I'm good right now. Thank you.
Hey, real quick, I got to tell you, two seasons ago, my fantasy baseball team's name was Volley Fingers. As a nod to
it.
You. So we didn't do that well, though. I didn't live up to the name. So,
and it's okay. It's baseball.
Yeah, man.
Best of luck this weekend at Auburn. And, hey, get some ice for that arm because it seems like the bullpen's going to need you all year.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
I appreciate you. VolleyFingers@yahoo.com if you want to help support a good cause. The baseball team is now going to kind of come into the main focus as, you know, basketball is over. Spring football has been fairly, I don't want to say boring, but, yeah, kind of boring, which is okay. That means your program is in a pretty healthy spot. You're not worried about quarterback battles or position battles just all across the field. You kind of got an idea of what you have. You got some stars on, you know, both sides of the ball, and it's just been kind of business as usual. So we turn our full attention to baseball. Going down to Auburn and taking on a team that hasn't had a lot of success so far this year, but they've played maybe the toughest schedule in the conference.
Yeah.
The television schedule kind of says it all. Every game's SEC Network Plus. So.
Yeah, no marquee games there that are getting any type of rub. And
get ready to operate that ESPN app.
Yeah. I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, I would love a very boring series this weekend.
That'd be nice.
That's what I would love. I would love if it was just boring and Tennessee was able to kind of do what other teams have done to Auburn so far. That would be nice. It's been a while since we've broken the brooms out in conference play. Let's break the brooms out. We haven't got to do that so far this year. Appreciate Kirby joining us. On behalf of, you said, the East Tennessee Children's Hospital?
Yeah, East Tennessee Children's Hospital. And, you know, my kids have given them a lot of business. It's a great place. It's one of the best, you know, children's hospitals in the region, without a doubt. Very, very highly regarded. They do great work there. So I'm happy to hear he's linked with them, doing some things with them.
Sam, send us to break. It's the morning show on Fan Run Radio.
A brand.
Baby, when I met you there.
Did you blow that traffic just there, Sam?
No, it's fully loaded. Commander Chuck blew that one.
All right, Commander Chuck, get it together. We're going to send these out. You make us look You make us look bad, come mostly on. Sam. You make Sam look like a schmohawk. Which, by the way, only one episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm left. I watched this week's last night, and Bob, I told you at the beginning, I thought it was headed for an ending where he ends up in jail, getting arrested and doing prison time, kind of like they did at the end of Seinfeld that made everyone mad. And it does seem like they're at least playing with that all season long with his court case and his arrest in Atlanta. It does feel like he is going to try to, which would be very Larry David, just to give, you know, a middle finger to the people who had hated the Seinfeld ending, just to be like, yeah, I'm going to run it back. Go do it again. The big news of the sports world, it isn't Tennessee going down to Auburn. I'm really into that series, and I hope Tennessee gets the brooms out and gets a sweep. But we actually got a little breaking news yesterday in the NFL, a story that came across that we had kind of talked about. It had been rumored. You kind of was reading the tea leaves, and you kind of knew it might happen. But you got your first big trade of the offseason leading into the draft as Stephon Diggs, top 10 wide receiver, top 10 over the last couple years especially, is officially on the move to the Houston Texans. Sam, what was your initial take? Was it just, oh my God, I hate the Texans? Because that's what mine was.
Kind of. I didn't think this is as big of like a needle mover as a lot of people thought, I feel like. To me, Diggs has kind of been declining for a little while, and the Texans aren't paying it. The Bills are paying it, so I guess I shouldn't bring that point up. But big contract he was under. Brandon Bean and the Bills are choosing to eat that one and trade him away. So I feel like there's a little something more to this one than just Stephon Diggs as the player.
So wait, the Bills who are in salary cap hell are just saying, hey, don't worry about it, we'll pick up most of the tab?
They ate $31 million in dead cap and have lost $3 million to this year's cap just for him to not play on the team in 2024.
Well, he's got that diva wide receiver mentality for sure. Like, mm-hmm. he's probably the poster boy for it over the last 2 years, right? Like, since Mr. Big Chest, AB84, retired and started CTESPN, like, I feel like Diggs is the guy we look at as kind of carrying the mantle of the unstable wide receiver who might want to fight as quarterback at some point. Antonio Brown had that crown, and then he left, and it feels like Diggs picked it up.
Yeah, his sideline tantrums are pretty epic and pretty regular, too. And that's what I think you heard it on Cowherd yesterday, too, was, you know, his sources were saying, like, in the last year, Allen has been kind of saying on the side, I'm kind of over the drama. So you got to believe Josh had some input on this one, too.
Or at least didn't fight to keep him.
Right.
Diggs blows up on him or the coaches probably at least once every two games, at least he did last year. And as Sam said, on the decline, at least his numbers, you know, he went from 1,400 yards in 2022 and 11 touchdowns on 108 catches in 16 games to 1,183, 8 touchdowns on 107 catches in 17 games. Strangely enough, his targets went up in 2023 compared to where they were in 2022. But Diggs is, you know, 30 years old. That's the danger zone for wide receivers in general. And if you're the Bills and you're eating this dead cap space, you're okay with it because you get a second round pick, which ironically enough comes from Minnesota, not Houston. It comes from Minnesota, the team that drafted Diggs and kind of helped him break into the league and become a mainstay. Now the question, though, is what does Buffalo have left? Because there's a correlation, and, you know, we always talk about correlation doesn't necessarily equal causation, but there's a big correlation that in this instance I would say is probably also rooted in causation of Josh Allen's stats with Stephon Diggs and without Stephon Diggs on the team. Now, he was a young quarterback getting his feet wet, but, like, you can't deny that Allen didn't take off and become a top three, top four guy the moment he had Stephon Diggs on the roster. You know, Diggs came in and gave him that number one target now they don't have a number one target. And correct me if I'm wrong, Sam, they also lost Gabe Davis this offseason, right? So, like, correct. Their number two target from last year also gone. So Buffalo completely kind of devoid right now of wide receiver talent, or at least wide receiver depth.
I believe Curtis Samuel is their wide receiver one right now, maybe.
No, Khalil Shakir.
Okay, yeah.
Who came on a little bit last season, but still, I mean, that's a big drop from Diggs and Gabe Davis. Samuels is the number two.
Well, the point kind of remains the same. Those guys seem somewhat interchangeable, which, you know, I don't know who will be listed number one or number two, but point is they got two guys that haven't really proven that either one of them can be a number one receiver.
Right.
A number two receiver.
Yeah, I mean, Samuel had some moments, I guess. But, yeah, like Curtis Samuel, Khalil Shakir, Justin Shorter, and Matt Collins, which screams that Buffalo is going to be looking to acquire someone either via trade or in the draft. They draft down at number 28. I don't know if they'll be able to get a big-time wide receiver down at 28. It seems like there's been plenty of talents, you know, get drafted in the 20s, but you got to find them, and that makes that pick much more pressure-filled.
That could be a Ladd McConkey range guy, which, again, you know, could be great, but not a guarantee that that's a number one guy in the making.
Do you think they'd have any interest in trying to trade up?
You don't
often get trades up for wide receivers, especially from 20 picks back, you know, where they'd have to get one of the three main guys, or at least one of the two main guys. It happened before when the Falcons came up and got Julio. And if you're the Falcons, you would say, yeah, that trade worked out because Julio became, you know, the franchise's best player and an all NFL, you know, first team caliber player, an all pro. I just don't know if they're in position, as they're kind of crunching the salary cap as it is, to waste valuable assets to try to move up to get somebody like that.
Yeah.
Maybe they move up 8 to 10 spots and, you know, there's like a Brian Thomas or a Donnie Mitchell, someone like that. But I agree with you. I think that's a huge leap to try to get up and get one of those top two or three guys.
Well, it's also a huge risk to try to draft a wide receiver in the first round, expecting him to come in and be your number one wide receiver. You know, I think the guys at the top, people are really, really sold on Marvin Harrison Jr. and Malik Nabers. It seems like Rome Odunze has kind of fallen back a little bit. At one point, those three kind of seemed interchangeable, or at least really close. Nabers and Odunze at least seemed interchangeable. It seems like he's fallen back a little bit out of that first upper echelon tier. Is that fair?
I don't think he's fallen back at all. I just think Nabers has risen more than Odunze has fallen.
Okay, so the gap has gotten wider, though.
Yeah, I think Odunze is still like a guaranteed top 10 pick.
Okay. I think the latest Field Yates two-round mock, I think I saw him going right around 10 or 11.
Yeah.
But it felt like at one point it was mentioned to maybe be there for the Titans or gone even. Like maybe at one point I saw people saying it's going to be three wide receivers and three quarterbacks as your first six picks. Seems like he's fallen a little bit in that regard.
Mm-hmm.
But now it becomes very interesting what Buffalo does. Do we view Josh Allen as the type that can elevate anybody? Because Patrick Mahomes, you know, the guy that just won the Super Bowl, he is that guy. We saw that, right? Like, he has Travis Kelce, yeah, sure. But, like, as far as wide receivers, he might as well have me, you, and Bob out there catching passes.
Yeah, he definitely reinforced the theory that as much as we love to covet wide receivers, you don't necessarily have to have the top tier to be a Super Bowl team. I don't know. I don't know if Josh is quite the same talent as Mahomes, though. I think that's a lot on him now.
Well, we know he's not the same talent as Mahomes, because Mahomes has already, you know, proven he can be that guy. I feel confident in saying Allen's at least a tier below. Whether or not he can elevate a team, we still haven't really seen either. Now, he's played really good games, and and he's been really good in the regular season. He's even had some playoff moments. You know, I thought he was pretty good in their defeat to the Chiefs, although he missed a couple passes that could have won that game. But, yeah, it's dangerous whenever you're trying to pick in the late teens, early 20 range, and looking for a number one receiver. Just ask the Titans and Treylon Burks, who thought, like, hey, yeah, we'll give up A.J. Brown and we'll just replace him with the first-round pick, and that has been a big disaster. Now, granted, I don't think it's the same type of move because A.J. Brown was still young and entering his prime, where I do think they're selling at the right time with Stephon Diggs. The Texans might squeeze out one more really good year with him, but I got no issue with the Bills moving on. The issue is just what's left. You tell me to get rid of Diggs, I'm saying, okay, yeah, that checks out, and you add the locker room stuff and his personality on top of it, and you're like, yeah, I get it. Get him out of here. Now the question is, what do you do? Who do you bring in? It's funny, Bob, you mentioned the wide receivers not needing a top one to win a Super Bowl. Because we never fully have that discussion. I've kind of brought it up in the past when people make fun of running backs, and you can't win with a top-paid running back. I'm like, well, yeah, we'll look through, and you don't win with a lot of top-paid wide receivers either, but people don't scream about that. They just say, yeah, pay them. And really, for a long time, you didn't win with top-paid quarterbacks. It was only like Eli Manning who had been like a top two or three paid quarterback until Peyton 1-16, I believe, is how it went. And now, of course, Mahomes is showing you can do both, although you could argue Mahomes is still kind of a bargain at his contract. The top receivers don't necessarily lead to Super Bowls. Julio almost did it. A guy we mentioned earlier, like he almost carried that team to a Super Bowl and had, you know, a jaw-dropping catch to what should have set up the field goal that put it out of reach. Instead, Matt Ryan took a sack. But are you saying there's just that if you were running a team, Bob, you would just want to keep kind of rotating these wide receivers?
No, not necessarily. And, I mean, I think we've seen some good receivers on teams. You know, you think back to that Bengals team a couple of years ago, you know, with Chase and others. But I just think that it's stating the obvious, it's a quarterback driven league. I mean, that's the key thing. And maybe even take it a step further, and, you know, depends on the stuff that, I guess my point is, the stuff that's not as sexy, the offensive line, things like that, those are as key a component to me as a receiver. I love to follow wide receivers and even running backs for that matter. But I do think there's a level of more interchangeability there than maybe we realize.
This was in August of 2022. But of 22 Super Bowls, of the previous 22 Super Bowls, you know, going into 2022, so basically of this millennium, only three had first team wide receivers on there. And I know that it's not always exactly related in terms of what production you have versus your salary, but typically the top paid guys are going to be all pro, and yeah, only three had won a Super Bowl into 2022. Cooper Kupp, you know, was awesome in the Rams Super Bowl. I don't know exactly where he was paid. But, yeah, he was awesome. He was a difference maker. But outside of that, like, you had Tyreek Hill with the Chiefs, but then they looked and said, hey, yeah, we're good. We're going to get rid of you. You're solid. Going to get rid of you. And then they come back and won, you know, a Super Bowl very easily without him. Not everybody can do that. Does this change how you view the Bills? Because, you know, they still on FanDuel have the, you know, they're tied for the fourth best odds. 49ers, Chiefs, and Ravens are the three best, and then you've got kind of a trio of teams with the Cowboys, Lions, and Bills. They still are getting that type of reputation, that type of rub. Do you view them on that same tier?
Hard for me. It feels like they've let a lot of guys go, too, in the offseason.
Yeah, I mean, their entire defense, the secondary, you know, they're their defensive backfield seems to be completely new, which, you know, maybe isn't the worst thing because those guys did seem to kind of stay banged up over the last couple of years, and maybe you're able to kind of replace it with younger, cheaper guys. It's not necessarily a bad thing. You're losing a lot of name value, but I don't know how elite those guys still were. Sam, do you view the Bills as a legit contender now?
Not as much. Yeah, I mean, I think that this Bills team is – I think the books are kind of catching up to them. They've got, you know, a lot of work to do. Or they did a lot of work, I guess, this offseason in terms of changing around, you know, a bunch of that defense like you guys have been talking about. And, you know, trading Diggs, obviously, they're just – feels like they're really trying to clear the books a little bit more and kind of reset. I think that they've – they obviously know that they're not out of their Super Bowl window with Josh Allen, but I do feel like it seems like a little bit of the window is closed a little bit, and they're kind of retooling this a little bit to try and prolong it, keep it open for a little bit longer.
Are they still the best team in that division, or is it Miami? I mean, you know, Miami's been kind of a head-scratcher for us the last couple of seasons, and I mean, they've made a few changes too, but I don't know, do we think they've fallen that far?
Projection-wise, they're still ahead of Miami. They're still going to be favored in that division. I think Miami took a step back. But if I'm the Jets, I'm looking and saying, oh, baby, my two teams I'm chasing are kind of having a really bad offseason, and we're having a good offseason. We found us a left tackle. He's old, but, hey, he can still play, and we're adding a former, you know, multiple-time MVP to our quarterback position. You know, I know Rodgers was there last year, obviously, but he didn't play. So if I'm the Jets, I'm like, yeah, this is great for us. The Texans get pushed up to having the third best odds to win the AFC, tying them with the Bengals and Bills. They got the Texans, Bengals, and Bills kind of all together right there at 7-1. We'll talk later in the show about what this means for the Texans and the Titans. We'll kick off hour two with some other headlines you missed from yesterday. It's called About Last Night. We appreciate White Claw, Hard Seltzer, and Cherokee Distributing for their support. When you're thinking of what to toast with this weekend, pick you up a 12-pack of White Claw Hard Seltzer. I prefer the Black Cherry. Or you can pick you up a bottle of the Premium Vodka or get some of their flavored vodka. The Black Cherry Vodka is pretty good. You just put a little hint of Sprite in there, Sprite Zero, and you're good to go. Hour one of the books, hour two coming at you. Stick with us. Don't put off your dental visits any longer. Dr. Stephen Malone and his staff take pride in listening and communicating with their patients to help them make the best decisions about their dental health. Going to the dentist ain't fun. No one likes going to the dentist, but if you do go to the dentist, you want to be confident that you are getting taken care of, and they want to take care of you, from routine dental cleanings to teeth removal, restorative procedures, or cosmetic things like veneers or implants, Invisalign. They can do it all at Knoxville Smiles. Contact them today at 865-539-1776 or take a virtual tour of their state-of-the-art West Knoxville facility at KnoxvilleSmiles.com. I'll tell you who's not smiling, and that's the NCAA. A rumored Super League. We've known that it's a possibility, but we get another ball roll, another domino falling, as college presidents were willing to go on record to talk about how much trouble the NCAA is in. You have major universities being open, talking with an NFL executive, trying to figure out what the best route is. And so far, Bob, what the update is that the system that's in place, it would be 70 fixed teams with 10 other teams able to kind of play their way up and down, relegation and promotion to get promoted to the big time.
Yeah, I think, you know, we talked about this a couple months ago, namely when the whole Tennessee versus the NCAA thing surfaced, and we use the term existential crisis for the NCAA. I think they just that got trumped. This is if this gets some traction, this is a bigger existential crisis for the NCAA, because the way I see it is just what you talked about. You know, it'd be one centralized level of control, promotion, relegation, getting their arms around NIL. You know, NIL would still exist, but the players would get paid directly. It would all come through this. They would get a commissioner, because how many times has there been chatter in the last year, at least, maybe longer, that the NCAA needs some sort of commissioner to run herd over what is going on or not going on in collegiate sports right now. I mean, all the talk is great. There's a lot of obstacles that could present itself in here, but the fact that that's beginning and they're bringing in serious players to carry on the conversation, I think it's very, very interesting. I think it's probably a step that needs to be taken.
It's funny you use the phrase existential crisis, because that's what West Virginia's president said. He said, we are in an existential crisis, saying, like, hey, yeah, no, the NCAA is in trouble. It's dead. That's what Syracuse's chancellor said. The current model for governing and managing college athletics is dead. So, like, they had two guys being willing to go on the record. I can't imagine that the NCAA is fond right now of the Syracuse chancellor or of the West Virginia president, but maybe that doesn't matter coming up soon. My initial thought was, man, seems like too many teams to be a super league. I get the idea of, like, hey, like, we're going to give everybody a chance to sign up for it if they want, but to me, what, 70 fixed teams and 10 others? 80? There's not 80 football teams that matter. And I don't know if there'll be 80 football teams that can afford to play this, unless they're all unified and do, like, some big, huge TV deal. But, like, what we've seen from the SEC and the Big Ten is that they realize they don't have to be unified.
Yeah, and I wonder if some of that's just to be intentionally, even if not sincerely, inclusive. You know what I mean? They're kind of like, yeah, man, we would include all these teams, knowing deep down there's going to be ones, like you said, that aren't going to be able to really afford to run at that level.
Is it that, or is it just, hey, the more teams we can get that are willing to do this, the bigger blow to the NCAA? Like, we're not just taking the SEC and Big Ten and leaving you the ACC and Big 12 and the Pac-12 leftovers and all that. No, we're taking everybody. Everybody's against you right now. It's not just 30 versus the country. It's 80 teams against the NCAA.
Yeah, I think it's what I said and that. You know what I mean? They're probably looking at ways to have every corner covered so that the NCAA doesn't have a countermeasure, so to speak.
Sam, I feel like you probably are miserable thinking about this, aren't you?
Not really, honestly.
Okay, that surprises me. Somebody who loves college athletics as much as you, I feel like, is going to be more hesitant to drastic change.
Yeah, I think I like the idea of doing this for football. I think I'm more of an old man when it comes to, like, mid-major basketball. But yeah, I can get away with, I'm all good with having best of the best with football together.
I think that's a good question, though. Do we think that maybe that's, you know, because obviously college football is such a big franchise in general. Is that really, that's the motivator here, right? I mean, everything you read about this conversation kind of ties into the TV rights tied to the college football playoff and that being an obstacle and things like that. To me, it's almost like, Sam, to your point, while they care about basketball, they really are focused on football. Yeah. I mean, that's really what it's about. And I think about schools like in our own conference, you know, Vanderbilt, this is not a great development for them. I mean, but it is what it is too. How many times have we talked about that? Like, God, it'd be great to have a relegation model for some of those types of schools.
Well, honestly, could you make the argument that we've kind of made with playoff, you know, expansion? Could you make the argument that Vanderbilt's now would have a goal each year that's more attainable?
Don't get relegated?
Yeah,
kind of like Wrexham.
Yeah, like just don't get relegated, and if you do get relegated, like strive for promotion, like
yeah.
Because you're not going to win the SEC ever if you're Vanderbilt. Like you have to know that you're not winning a national championship. You're not a main player. Like the best you can hope for is that you win 8 games and win a bowl game, and like that's those days are gone too with the way college football is set up. So like now you have like a tangible goal. Maybe that in the past is just like, hey, let's make a bowl game. I don't know, but like, hey, just don't get relegated.
I think it does make a reasonable point. Like, you can't tell me that Clark Lee is going in there, like, the first practice of the year and being like, all right, boys, like, championship mentality. Like, let's go win a national
bowl game eligibility mentality. Yeah. Come on.
The flip
side. Let's move up a division this year. That's more attainable.
The flip side to that is, as a university administrator, not Clark Lee, of course, he wouldn't want this, but as a university administrator, they're probably looking at it as it's easy money right now. We get all these distributions from the conference, just because we're part of it.
Yeah.
And you would think that some of that stuff would go away.
Well, would it? Or would they get to go just under the SEC umbrella and get to be a part of this and still get a similar cut?
Well, that's a good question. I wonder what happens. I think it begs a deeper question that this story can't even talk about yet is, what does it do to conferences in general if they, you know?
Said they would go away in this article I was reading, is that the conferences would cease to exist.
That's what I'm saying. So then what happens to all those distributions with media rights, everything else? It could be very different.
I'm sure ESPN and Fox would be completely fine if they got to kind of mix and match. And if you're the TV networks and you could create an Ohio State and Tennessee game or an Ohio State-Alabama game once every 2 or 3 years, and you just kind of rotate who gets to carry them. And like, hey, ABC, ESPN, you don't really get a lot of Michigan games. How about we give you a Michigan game, but we play them against Texas? Here you go. And like, I would imagine if those networks are willing to work together, like they said they have been over the last couple months, right? They've created their little alliance, and they're trying to expand the playoffs, and they're working together. It's like, hey, we're the two conferences that matter. I'd imagine that means ESPN and Fox are also willing to be like, hey, we can work together, because didn't the last TV deal for the playoff, Bob, didn't it have some flex options to, like, basically they could license out their games to other networks already?
Yes, that's true.
So that makes me think that they already kind of have a relationship going on.
Yeah, yeah, well, that was tied in with the expansion of the field and all of that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
But ESPN was still paying, like, fronting all the money for it, right?
Correct.
And they could just sell it to other networks.
Correct.
Like a CBS or, you know, a Fox.
Yeah, that's right.
Again, my takeaway is that it's too many teams to feel like a super league. When you tell me it's going to be 80 teams, it just feels like college football as it is already. To me, having just a setup of 10 teams that are trying to rotate in doesn't seem enough. Like, what happens the next year? Those 10 teams just play each other? They just do a round robin against each other? But if you're moving up 10 teams, like, how does that even work? I don't understand the relegation promotion aspect of it. I think you need to have more leagues and more divisions that you move up from. Like, I think there should be 2 or 3 leagues where you have, coming into the year, maybe 30 teams that are playing in the championship level. And then the bottom 5 move out, and the top 5 of the next one move up from second league to first league. And then you have a third league of the also-rans, the loser schools that are trying to get to the second league and build their way up.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think something else that's interesting here, too, is this whole notion. There's talk of creating an entity that would work with a union, basically, representing the players. So, you know, we think about NIL, transfer portal. I mean, we're just watching it happen right now with basketball, and I think with football, it's going to get even more pronounced over time. It feels like a runaway train on some of this stuff. It doesn't feel sustainable in its current state, the way it's being operated right now. And they need, again, I keep coming back to, you need some sort of governing body, and it's not the NCAA. They had their chance and they missed it, to kind of manage all of this. So it just, again, it's the Wild West out there right now.
You're right by calling it a governing body, but what they really need is a money boss. They need to drop the facade that it's amateurism, and that's why the NCAA can't govern it, is because they're trying to cling to amateurism. And like, they could solve their problems if they just made these kids employees and was able to kind of, you know, relegate and actually have rules, because the phrase the Wild West is accurate, and the transfer portal and all this stuff, these contracts are unenforceable. Because when you are making unpaid people stay at their school or follow certain guidelines, yeah, you run into actual legality issues now. And that toothpaste is out of the tube, if you will. It's not going in. Athletes in college athletics are just going to continue to get more power, not less. Once Congress made the decision of like, hey, yeah, the NCAA, you're wrong. What you're doing is kind of illegal. That was over. You know, that slippery slope got soaked up even more, and now you do need a governing body, and you do need to unionize. But that really is just code, to me at least, is like, hey, we got to quit pretending like these guys are amateurs. They're employees, and we got to kind of treat them that way and actually have some contracts where they're not necessarily making us recruit them every year. And the coaches are going to go crazy, too, with the transfer portal and everything. So, like, that's the way I read that. It's like, hey, amateurism's dead.
Yeah.
NIL is not sustainable. No one likes NIL. The players might like it a little bit because they're getting the opportunity to make more money, but, like, they would probably much rather just be guaranteed six figures to play football and not have to do all the endorsement stuff and not have to worry about their collective checks not coming through. They'd probably, like, the schools themselves probably, you know, don't necessarily love having to deal with these collectives.
Yeah.
They would rather say, hey, keep donating your money to the school and we'll allocate X amount of the funds to paying these players. Instead of making you give the money to these collectives, just give it to us and we'll figure out how to spend it. We want to handle it all and make sure our players are taken care of. Because, like, you know, we laugh whenever our rivals' collectives drop the ball, right? Like, whenever Jaden Rashada goes to Florida and gets screwed over and has to transfer and he leaves and, like, you know, Florida misses out on a top-ranked quarterback, we laugh. But, like, if I'm the University of Florida, I'm like, hey, we didn't do nothing wrong here. It wasn't us. We didn't default on this kid. We didn't promise him money and not pay it. It was our collective that we can't really do much with. We can't make sure the guys are getting paid. We can't pony up. But, like, it wasn't like you made fun of the Gator Collective. I don't even remember what the Gator Collective was called. We made fun of the University of Florida. Even, like, here in Knoxville with the Volunteer Club and Spire Sports and all that, like, it wasn't them kind of dominating the headlines when it came to the NCAA versus Tennessee and Nico. It was the NCAA versus Tennessee and Nico. And Tennessee's having to hope that everything from the Volunteer Club was on the up and up and that they can't get tied to something. I'd imagine in a perfect world, the school would like, hey, we'd like to just handle this and make sure our lawyers are overlooking everything and we're running contracts the right way. So I'd imagine the schools are kind of looking at that and saying, hey, this isn't the worst idea. It's like we talk about with gambling and legalized weed and everything. And you make it legal and you can kind of control it and, you know, govern it.
Yeah.
There's better regulations.
Sam, this kind of dovetails off of John's question earlier. So for the younger set, doesn't mean you guys aren't intelligent, but does this just make your head hurt just thinking about all this?
Morons.
In what sense?
Well, I'm just thinking, like, again, as someone who just, you love sports, I mean, is it like, this is just, I don't want to worry about this. I just want to root for my team, you know? It's like, and it makes me wonder how long it would take for something like this to take shape, too, by the way. I can't imagine this is anything, even if it gains greater traction because of the TV deals and everything else, it's going to be years down the line. And so then the question becomes, how long are we going to be talking about it before it's even reality?
I think the moving parts of it do suck. I do think, like you're saying, Bob, kind of in that transition phase of, you know, if you're going to this model eventually and it's not going to just be an immediate thing, surely it's going to be a kind of a multi-year thing. I feel like there is a chance where college football kind of loses its luster a little bit in that kind of transition, in that, you know, that phase from going to everything that everyone's used to kind of this new Super League stuff that a lot of people are probably going to be pushing back on.
And that's why I asked that question, is it, does, you know, so how's it feel from that angle? I'm thinking for the more mature folks that are, you know, maybe sometimes they're a little more get off my lawn, you know, I think it's going to, some of those folks, they're pissed off about the current state of things already. So I don't know if this helps fix that or not, or does it make it worse?
Yeah, I was going to say, you asked Sam from a young perspective. I'm more interested in you from an older perspective, because this would – I don't know if it would change college football completely, because the more I read about it, the more it sounds like it's kind of trying to return college football kind of to,
yeah,
to what it would be. Like, yeah, the conferences are gone, but, hey, we're still going to have, you know, 7-10-team divisions, and I'd imagine those would be kind of – they'll try to evenly balance it, but I imagine it would also still kind of be like geographically related. And Mike Florio's article that I was reading didn't do a good job of laying it out, because, you know, he called it an 80-team league and made it seem like 70 are up and 10 are fighting. The Athletic article says this is all 130 teams in college football, and that it would be 70 mainstay, and then the other, you know, 60 teams are competing for those final 10 spots year in, year out, which makes a little bit more sense relegation-wise. I was under the impression it was just 80 teams and 10 teams are trying to find their way up. And
no.
Okay, so yeah, it was 130 and 70 are mainstays. The 70 would be all five former major conferences plus Notre Dame and SMU.
Yes, that was my understanding too. And,
okay.
And that's why I said that earlier too. It's like, if it is all 130, is that just, again, are they – they're just like, yeah, you're all invited. You know, deep down they're thinking, you know, some of you aren't going to be able to hang, so – sure. And they're saying that all the schools would get some sort of percentage of the league, but it will be tiered. You know, some of the bigger brands are going to, you know, they're going to get a better distribution than others. But to your question, see, for me, I don't know. I consider myself kind of not so much the norm in my demographic, but I'm kind of an adopter of it needs to evolve, and where it is today, I don't particularly like it, but I'm open to something like this that could change it and make it better. I accept the fact that it's never going to be the way it was, never, no matter what shape it looks like or whatever shape it takes. But I'm open to I'm encouraged that there is a group out there that are credentialed and are smart people by all accounts that want to just get a greater level of control over this, because the way it is today, which I don't particularly like, if that evolves and without any governance in the next 5 years, I can't even imagine what it's going to look like.
I think they're doing themselves a disservice by calling it the Super League, because it makes me think about the Feld, you know, international soccer league that they tried to make, that basically the fans were like, nah, we're good. You know, we talk about Shiano Sunday all the time, like European soccer did that too, where they're just like, nah, we're good. Like, the Premier League is where we like. We don't want to, like, end all those ancient rivalries and take these big clubs and put them together. And nope, not going to do it. We're going to march through the streets and protest and basically have it fall completely apart. I feel like that's bad luck to try to call this the Super League, especially whenever, again, it's just college football. It's all it is. It's 130 teams.
Yeah.
I'm more interested in exclusivity. I don't want to have to play Vanderbilt in football anymore. Like, if Vanderbilt's still going to be in it, not a Super League. Sorry. If Mississippi State's going to be in it, not a Super League. I'd be interested in, like, taking 30 teams or 40 teams from across the country of the biggest brands and putting them together. And if even if you wanted to add in five or six promotion relegation opportunities there, like, I'm into that. But 130 to me is just, you're trying to call it a different league because you're trying to not scare people away from saying, yeah, we're actually just going to make it professional football and we're going to pay employees and have all that. Like, that to me, that's what this seems like.
I also think it, at least the face value, you know, and I do like, I'm intrigued by the promotion relegation format and how it works in, you know, English football and other soccer leagues. But if you apply that to college football, I wonder how that really works, just given the fact that there's a shelf life, a fixed shelf life for some of these players, right? They're, you know, if you're any sort of program, it's really going to be about how you build your program over the course of not a couple of years, it's going to be over the course of 5 to 6 years, because you're going to have players, some of your best players will come in and then cycle out, and you won't be able to control that. It's not like free agency per se. They only have a fixed amount of time at that institution. And So in that regard, if you're trying to build an allegiance to a team and think, you know, yeah, I want to work towards promotion, I don't know. Like for a Vanderbilt, how realistic is that? You know, I don't know if it is.
To me, whenever you start talking about this, it's going to eventually happen.
Yeah.
Like it's been rumored, it's a snowball rolling down a hill. We might be 10 years away from it. But assuming I don't die early, prematurely, it'll happen in my lifetime. Sam, it'll happen in your lifetime. Bob, I'd say it happens in your lifetime. Like in the next 10 years, I would imagine this isn't going away, right? Like you think it's that soon? Is 10 years too extreme? 20 years? Because like the TV,
no, it's I'd say 10 years or less.
Yeah, okay. I feel like
I think they're gonna sooner. They've talked yeah. about that. Again, the network groups are, for this to work, they'd have to modify their rights agreements because some of those run in well into 2030, you know?
Yeah, I guess it just seems like things take a long time in college to actually happen, or at least that was the previous trend. Like we rumored that damn playoff for about 8 years before they finally gave it and said, yeah, 14 playoff, we'll do it.
Yeah, that's true.
But then, you know, we've gone from 4 to 12 to 14, you know, immediately. So, like, yeah. Maybe they've decided, hey, there's too much money to be waiting around. Let's just get this done as soon as possible. Hey, you know, conference realignment, some of this stuff's going to happen. Nope, let's just go ahead and do it. We're not going to wait any longer. USC and UCLA, we're not going to pretend like we're not going to leave. Let's just go ahead and do it. And that came together within, like, it felt like 2 weeks. Texas-Oklahoma was maybe a year or so, like, where it was kind of rumored, but... Yeah, maybe college just moves faster. Maybe 10 years is way too long. That's just whenever the ESPN-SEC agreement runs out. So it'll kind of be like the last hurdle. But I'd imagine those networks can figure it out. They got enough high-dollar lawyers to figure it out and make it mutually beneficial. It's the Super League that's just all of college football. So I've got to wrap my head around that. Any final thoughts?
There's a lot, and I agree with you. I think some of this is inevitable to happen. It's just a matter of how does it work. I mean, they've already, they pitched it to, as this article reads out, they pitched it to the ACC Board of Directors, but then they tried to follow up with administrators from the Big Ten, SEC, and Big 12, and those were all called off. And, you know, there's still some of that feeling each other out part that's going to have to happen. It's going to take some time.
The SEC and Big Ten probably had to be like, hey, we got to call.
Yeah.
Got to call our bosses at the networks to figure out if they're going to be offended by this.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're giving us a lot of money. We don't want to make them mad.
Yeah. The Big 12 is kind of a subset of those two. And they, they default to what those two do between the Big Ten and SEC. So, yeah, I agree.
Sam, send us to break. It's the morning show on Fan Run Radio.
Back on the morning show, last half hour of the show. This is a little bit of a bittersweet segment coming up because we have really enjoyed spending time with assistant coach Greg Polinsky during the basketball season. And we'll be kind of wrapping it up today, and we sure do appreciate his time and his insight over the season, and we'll get to it right now. Coach, good morning. How are you, man?
I'm doing fine, guys. How are you?
We're good. Two quick things. First off, a mutual friend I bumped into last night said hello. Frank Ambuza said he wanted, to say hi. And then let's talk about just a little bit. I mean, Sunday's probably in the rearview mirror for a lot of people. But I wanted to get your take because I was watching the game on TV. The guy sitting to my right was there rooting you on in person. But what I could see on TV, and John reaffirmed it, was, you know, just how loud it was in there, the intensity. And my wife and I could see you on the sidelines. You were as animated as we ever see you. From your perspective, your vantage point right there, what that game felt big time on every single level. But I mean, did you kind of feel that electricity as well? I mean, I know there were a lot of frustrating moments, but that game just, it was like a prize fight.
Yeah, it was a great basketball game. You're right about the atmosphere, the environment. Vol fans showed up, you know, loud and proud, and we appreciated that. You know, the advantage of being a number one seed is the proximity, you know, which you earn over the course of the year. A little bit closer for Purdue fans, and they showed up with a great contingency and made it an incredibly loud place. During my scouting days, I had an opportunity to go to Mackey Arena on a number of occasions. Always thought it was one of the better home crowds in basketball. So they provided, we provided, our fans that were there provided a really electric, dynamite atmosphere that was, for the lack of a better word, fun, you know, to be a part of. It was what it's all about. It's what you work hard for. It's what our players earned over the course of the year. And, no complaints, no gripes, man. We gave a good effort and really proud. I think Coach, you know, summed it up in the best way and in a gracious, classy manner. You know, about what the players meant to him, what the season meant to him, and more importantly, what it was about with our players, which it always is.
After a loss like that, where you can feel comfortable that the players played well, the effort was there, you know, nobody cheated the game, everything was left out on the court, how long does it take to get over a loss like that? Is it one that you're able to just say, hey, you lost to a team that was a little bit better that day, or do you just kind of replay in your mind a couple of the possessions that maybe if one or two things go differently, the result ends up differently?
Yeah, I think, you know, I can't answer for Coach. I know how he is. He'll break down. I mean, just watching Coach go through practice is, you know, he dissects everything and wants to know what we could have done better as players and coaches. And, you know, there's a humility to everything that goes about this program. And so, you know, for me, you know, like, and I'm sure coaches, you know, I've looked at it three times and, you know, going back through moments and, you know, it's like a great movie you watch and you pick up something different each time, you know. But, yeah, there were moments, you know, we had our opportunities and got out to the 11-point lead and had some really good looks at the rim and didn't go down. And there, as we know, 33-4 for a reason, as I always say. The big fella's unique. He is incredibly large and skilled. I know people are frustrated with parts of the game, but I think, again, Coach said it right. You know, you think about, there's a lot of ways officials can practice watching games. Different styles of play, teams at press, teams at zone. It's impossible to practice what you're going to see with Zach Edey just because he's so unique to the game. And so, like, that wasn't the game, you know. I mean, I know you didn't ask me that question, but could there have been a couple of things here and there that they may have, you know, whistled on Zach? Sure. But I thought our guys gave their all. The game was truly decided on the court. We had some great looks at the beginning, in the middle, and at the end. And I'm not sure, you know, we would have done a whole lot different. We picked our poison in that game. They're the top 3-point field goal percentage shooting team in the country. A lot of that comes from inside our passes from Edey. And we just decided how we were going to play him. And our guys actually did a good job of trying to dig when they could and not believing their guys. I think they hit three threes in the game. One was a big one. But, yeah, I mean, you, with a team like that, they're well-balanced. They have great roster construction. And Matt Painter's a very good basketball coach. So, hey, you know, we tip our caps, and we wish it would have been us. It hurts, and it hurts for our seniors and all our guys that put so much into this. But I think there's a lot more to be proud of about this basketball team, and our fans have been awesome showing that all year long than a single game.
Yeah, you talk about the seniors, but I want to focus on a freshman because I did think J.P. Estrella gave you some really good minutes trying to stop the big monster, Zach Edey. Can you talk a little bit about J.P. being able to step up in that moment and play at such a high level?
Sure. And I thought all these guys, all our guys gave an effort. I mean, let's start with J.P., you know, called upon to play 15 minutes at the highest level game. I kidded with him after our team meeting. I said, boy, you've come a long way from Maine and Brewster Academy, which is a very good prep school, but a little different level of seeing bigs. And he laughed about it, you know, like J.P. would, and smiled. But it's he did great, man. He fought. His physicality's improved so much. His cardio toughness has improved. That was the things. I think people in Tennessee should be really excited about J.P., as they should a number of guys, but he's going to be a really fine player. He can really score the ball, and he really fought hard in the game. I thought Tobey, we all knew what he would do, fought really hard. And listen, you know, Jonas has given us a great season. All guys play differently or stylistically in different games based upon what they're about, what the opponent's about. That's a tough go for Jonas. No excuses, but Jonas had an incredible year for us, and I don't want that to get lost in one game. There's no one that took it harder than him. But we're excited about our core of big guys, and as you mentioned, JP for sure in that group.
So, Coach, now, you know, a couple days have passed. I'd be interested to kind of understand from a top-line perspective what the wind-down is like now. You know, you obviously have some post-tournament meetings. You know, does Coach meet individually with the players? How do you guys proceed? And I know in this day and age, too, it just becomes even in some ways more hectic because now the focus probably moves towards, you know, transfer portal, who could be incoming, all those types of things. What's the next, you know, couple of weeks look like?
Yeah, so we had a team meeting. Now all these days have run together. Do I want to say Monday or Tuesday, I believe. It was fantastic. It's just, I wish I could share, you know, the entire meeting with all the listeners and people just to show you what a great, great group of kids we have. They're not kids, they're men. Things shared and, you know, Coach Barnes was phenomenal. And it was a meeting of gratitude, you know, it really was about what we did. And we'll never stop being hungry in this program. You know, that's just not how it is. We want this next step for our fans and for our players. And I truly believe we'll get there. But, you know, it's now give the players a little time to, you know, unwind. We will, you know, come back and meet with the young men that are going to return, talk with them, you know, about the expectations for the spring when we begin our workouts. Knowing our guys, they're probably already in the gym as you and I are speaking right now. And, you know, player meetings, you know, sit down. We always sit down with our players. We want feedback from them. It's really not us talking at them. It's with them to see where they are and what they thought about the year. And, you know, again, when you're dealing with high-character guys, those meetings are really insightful and a lot of fun. Very helpful, very beneficial going forward for all. And then we'll get busy working in the gym. Our job is once we understand, you know, what everybody's intention is and, you know, what are we going to need to help this team. I think it would be a little unrealistic to think we're going to find Dalton again in the portal.
Yeah.
That is one special young fella. And, but we're going to go out. We believe we have a great core of young men. You know, we basically do it with our group of returners, but just like a good NBA franchise, you've got to look in free agency, dip in, and see which players can come in and complement your core. So that, and obviously we're continuing on with our 25s, you know, that we 24s, if there's somebody available or some pops, anybody that can help our basketball team that fits culture, Tennessee, we'll be looking at.
Coach, when you're looking back just on the season as a whole, where do you think this team has kind of grown the most collectively from the start of the summer to the end of the year that makes you the most proud as a coach on this roster?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would think it would be like things that you mentioned. Even guys like as great a leaders as Josiah and Santi were coming into this year, I think what they did from mid-year on was phenomenal. You'd have to be there daily to appreciate it. No knock at you guys. You have jobs too. But I could be there. And so to witness it, it was pretty special. You know, to see how selfless, we use that word a lot, but it's true, they were. Then what you mentioned, like the growth of not only JP, but Kate Phillips and Freddie DeLeon. I remember him coming in the Creighton game. You can think about Cam coming in the Creighton game and making a corner three. Freddie making a great pass in transition to Dalton. His effort defensively. I think just the maturity, and I don't want to leave out any of our players, but those guys, like, to have to sit, watch. They have some tougher, older vets in front of them. And then, like, true pros to be ready to go when their name was called and execute what was being done. I think, again, leadership and then the young guys buying into that. Obviously, I could go through every guy on a roster, and I don't think that's what you're looking for. But, man, what Jemiah Meshack, Z continues to bring, you know, Jordan Ganey, I could go through everybody. I don't want to leave anybody out. It's just a team of high-character guys that never really complained about their own minutes, but were excited about the 40 minutes. And that is really, really hard to do and duplicate. And I'll make one statement, and I don't post anything on social media because I might. My daughters warned me, Dad, you don't know what you're doing. So don't post anything. And I said, okay. Not that they meant anything, you know, ridiculously bad, but, you know, I might put in something about my profile. So that's my joke, guys, by the way. We can kind of laugh. I think what Santiago Vescovi, you know, did for this program, somebody listed his accomplishments, and it was really neat, I think, how they ended it. Basically saying, I don't want to hear one word about Santiago Vescovi unless it's positive. And that's the way it should be. Same with Josiah. What those guys did, and Josiah had some games. You know, Santi this year wasn't nearly, you know, let's just say it, the scorer, the shooter that he had been. But what Santi did over the course of his career, being around him every day, guys, I was in the NBA 23 years, and I will tell you, and this came from a GM in the league, there's not five smarter players he's ever seen. And that includes everybody. That's in the world. What he did for our program, his competitive edge, how he's a savant. Like, that guy is so unique, and I'm not sure we even realize how much we're going to miss Santi and Joe until we get there next year. So I know our fans really do appreciate those guys, but I hope all the people that are sitting on the fence just take my word for it. They are special in terms of impacting winning.
Yeah, we're with you, man. This has been a special team just for all the reasons you just said too. It's not just what happens on the court. We feel that aura of leadership and just composure that those guys brought to it. They're absolutely going to be missed. Coach, one more question that I have as we kind of wind this down. You did a great job of just talking about the returning core, because there is a lot to be enthusiastic and optimistic about with that group. And you also touched on the obvious, you know, finding another Dalton Connect is, you know, maybe a fool's errand. That might be really tough to do, but if you and, you know, Coach Barnes and the whole staff are looking at gaps besides the obvious, which is the points that Dalton could bring to the table and all the other little things, as well as what Josiah and Santi did to the for this team as well, what do you see as the biggest gap as you're looking at, you know, potentially transfer portal, et cetera, as far as what could be additive to this team? And to your point also with an eye to, it's got to be a cultural fit, man. Chemistry is just as important as anything here.
Yeah, I think, well, number one, you can never have enough shooting. Never. So we'll always look at that. And we'll look at our roster construction, and I'm hopeful that everybody on this team will want to return. I'm always amazed at looking at guys that leave programs that have had success there, and the programs had great success. But in this day and age, we know that's an option for any player on any team anywhere in college basketball. So I think, you know, evaluating our own group, knowing what our roster will look like, and then, again, roster construction. What do we think we need, which is the question you ask. Shooting, you always need. You know, and Santi and Joe, obviously Dalton, you lost three guys that are very capable. And although the average fan may not think this, you know, but we used to call it a gravity score. Santiago Vescovi had a high gravity score. You didn't see many teams just leave him alone. So that opened up driving gaps, right, because there's more space on the court. So shooting does a lot of things for you other than the shooter just making shots. Sure, he's got to make enough of them to be respected. But, you know, maybe a dynamic guy, you know, that, again, I don't know that we're going to find Dalton that – as dynamic as he was off the bounce, as well as shooting the ball, but somebody that can do that. I think we got guys in our program right now that are going to get better with it. That's exciting in the spring. I don't have any question that you're going to see an elevated Jemiah Meshack and Jordan Ganey and Cam Carr. And, you know, I'm basically speaking perimeter guys. Zakai is going to improve. I mean, I could go through it. Freddie is really good off the dribble. And once he finds his niche, so we'll see how all this runs. But, again, I think shooting, I think, can we replace Josiah, finding someone with some versatility all over the court? What Joe did defensively, being able to guard 1-4 and shoot the ball, was a huge advantage for our basketball team. So we'll look at that, and we feel pretty good about our front line. And but I would say shooting and some dynamic creators on the perimeter or a creator. But, again, a lot of it depends on, we've always been about the guys we have and our player development, and we're proud of that, and we're proud of our players for putting in the time.
Coach, appreciate the time. Appreciate you wrapping up the season with us. Enjoyed talking to you. Best of luck this off season. Best of luck at the transfer portal, and hope to talk to you, I guess, what, in about October? About 6 months
hey,
from
listen,
now?
Whenever you'll have me back. And listen, if your fans need a little variety, I understand that, you know, Baskin-Robbins has 31 flavors for a reason. So if you need a little variety, but I certainly enjoyed my time with you guys, and thank you for having me.
Thank you so much.
Love you, Coach. Thank you, man.
Thanks, see you, guys. Thank you, guys.
Got to be honest, that one just kind of made me sad. That one just kind of made me sad. I think he knew we were sad, too. He said, come on, guys, laugh at my joke. That was a joke.
I now feel like basketball season really is over.
Right? Yep, that was the final straw for us.
Yeah.
I just had my exit meeting with Coach, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice of Coach to still put over the fans that showed up, even though I know he didn't. I know he was doing the nice thing, and the ones that did show up were allowed. Shout out to him. He loves putting the fans over. Loves his time here, and I do think – that the one phrase that you could take away from that interview is him saying that, like, hey, the program is going to stay hungry.
Yeah.
Because that's a good way to kind of describe a Rick Barnes team, is they do play hungry. Like, and the culture you mentioned, Bob, and he, you know, chimed in that, yeah, like, that's probably the number one thing we're actually looking for, because you got to come in hungry and you got to be willing to do the small things. And that, to me, is probably my lasting impression of Josiah and Vescovi. If you're looking just for offensive points, you're going to come up frustrated about half the time. But if you're looking for playing basketball the right way and making those right plays and setting a culture, then, you know, those two together are about as good as any duo over the last, you know, 30 years at Tennessee. About to start crying, excuse me. That duo about as good as anybody at Tennessee over the last 30 years.
One of the things I mentioned at the outset of the show that we apparently have a mutual friend, and that guy was in touch with Coach Barnes after the game. It was the day after, it wasn't like right after. But he said he talked to Coach, and he was still watching film from that game. You know what I mean? It was like it underscores what Greg said about hungry. You know what I mean? He's already starting to analyze, okay, what went wrong? How can we get better? What's gonna be a difference maker moving forward? I appreciate that. You know, your season's over, but the way they're treating it is it's not over. It's a year-round endeavor. So I think that's great.
I can't imagine going back and watching that game and having to break down the film. I mean, credit to Barnes for doing that, but
as like a head coach, yeah. Hurts me as a fan.
I guess as a head coach, you got to put on your head coach hat and be like, hey, here's what you have to get better on in the offseason. Hey, here's something I noticed. But, like, it wasn't a game that you lost because of a lack of effort. It wasn't even really a game because of lack of execution, really. I mean, Tennessee just didn't make shots down the stretch, and there's not really anything defensively you can do with a 7'4" Giants like they have that's also big and pretty athletic. Like, you probably aren't going to have to run up against a guy like that in the tournament next year. So, like, how much time can you spend breaking down how to defend him? He's not going to matter. But, yeah, credit to Barnes for putting in the work. I for one, never want to watch that game again.
Well, they've got another 7'3" guy coming in. You're going to have to figure out a way to –
hopefully he's not as good.
They've got a 7'2" guy on the bench and a 7'3" recruit.
Oh, they've got a 7'2" guy on the bench?
Yeah, Willie Berg. He's a sophomore from Sweden.
Where do they find these kids?
Yeah. I can't imagine either one's going to be to the level of skill that faced with Edie. I just don't see it. That's very rare.
Sam, any final thoughts?
Just a great season. It hurt. That one twisted the knife a little bit more. I thought I had taken it out. That one just kind of put it back in.
That was somebody sticking a finger in
the
hole of your wound that you thought was healing. They just take it and just jab you right there in the collarbone where you've been shot or stabbed. Bob, what about you? Any final thoughts?
No. Again, what you said I took to, and it encourages me of – that's what you want your coaching staff to be like. It's like, okay, we're not satisfied. That was a great run. This was a great team, but we're about being excellent every year. And as a fan base, man, that's what we want to hear. And that's our team, man. That's our coach. It did hurt a little, but I come away still with a great amount of optimism too, particularly if they can make a little hay in the transfer portal, because I believe in what they do in terms of chemistry. They just got to get the right guy to fit. That's all.
It's portal season. That's my final thought. It's portal season.
Yep.
G.I. Jake Show coming up next. Stay locked in on Fan Run Radio.